After more than 2 years, the trial of Karen Reed for the death of her boyfriend, John O'Keefe, is underway.
It's a case being watched across the country.
What a day. What a buildup to this moment.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
Unlike anything that we have ever seen in our careers.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this.
I've never seen a story where there's been this much anticipation for the beginning. It's right there with Alec Murdoch, O.J. Simpson, and those types of cases.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah.
And he's also under internal affairs investigation.
We asked Karen Reed about that alleged confession. Karen, did you ever say, I hit him?
I did not.
This case never ceases to amaze me.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
And the prosecution came out swinging with the first testimony today.
I know that the prosecution is putting on its case right now, but so far, I feel like I'm watching the defense put on its case. How can that be?
The fact that the investigation wasn't thorough provides a big wrinkle in the prosecution's case.
Everybody wants to know, us included, why he wouldn't go inside that home on the night that the body was discovered outside the home of Brian Albert, another Boston police officer.
We really heard the defense highlight some of the discrepancies between what was documented and what first responders said they remembered.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos and also texting his friends that he hoped Karen Reed would kill herself.
They're supposed to be creating this reasonable doubt, and they're doing exactly that.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
A hearing was scheduled and held on Thursday, April 25th, for some of the motions that haven't been decided yet. Some things are coming in without objection from either party, like the 911 call and photographs of the victim and of his injuries. I won't spend too much time going over every motion, but I want to hit some of the highlights and the things that might make a difference as we watch the trial unfold. First, we find out that the judge decided to move the trial to a different courtroom that's about a quarter of the size of the one that they've been using for the last 2 years. Here's why this matters. The jury now has a better view of the witness. We mentioned before that this is important when a juror is determining the credibility of whoever is on the stand. But moving to a smaller courtroom also has some other major impacts. Because of the smaller size, there won't be room for anyone to attend other than the family of the victim and the family of the defendant. Every pre-trial hearing has been packed, often standing room only. Having a crowd of supporters sitting behind a defendant isn't common. And it's something that the jury probably would have noticed. Is one option more beneficial to either side? It's hard to tell. But the unobstructed view of the witness probably makes for a fairer trial than a view of the supporters. The way the courtroom is situated now, Officer O'Keefe's family is sitting across the small room from the jury, and they're within reaching distance of Karen. The jury can't really look at Karen without seeing the O'Keefes. The body cam video that we listened to last week where Karen is saying that Brian and Colin Albert beat John up, that is going to be allowed in, but only in audio form, no video, and the judge said that context will be given. Another ruling that was made, there will be no reference to the ongoing federal investigation. The information about John and Karen's argument in Aruba will be allowed in, as well as evidence about any issues in their relationship, but the judge says that she will give limiting instructions to the jury that they can only consider it for establishing state of mind. Judge Cannone says it's a, quote, stretch, uphill battle, end quote, for the defense to have D.A. Morrissey called to the stand by the defense. But she's not ruling on this yet. She said that they can revisit this motion after the Commonwealth has presented its case. As for Steve Nelson, David Unetti says that he wants to call him to testify about a conversation that he had with Brian Higgins. Higgins apparently told the grand jury that Nelson gave him permission to get rid of his phone. No ruling on this motion at this point yet. There's also no ruling yet on bringing up the internal affairs investigation with the lead investigator, Trooper Proctor, for professional misconduct. Defense attorney Elizabeth Little says Proctor has motive to testify in certain way to protect his own career, which is why the jury needs to know this information so that it goes to the weight of his testimony. The judge ruled that the undetermined manner of death will be redacted from the death certificate, but this can be discussed in cross-examination. The jury will be able to go visit 34 Fairview Road, but Karen will not be present for this. And last but not least, let's talk about this hair. Again, the whole conversation of this lasted only 25 seconds, but we hear that the defense has withdrawn their motion to exclude this evidence. I mentioned in the last episode that the prosecution finally got the lab results that they've been discussing in every single hearing for over a year and turned them in as evidence. And rather than continuing the argument on this, the defense withdraws their motion to exclude it.
Defendant's motion for sanctions and exclusion of evidence based on the Commonwealth's failure to timely comply with discovery orders. Mr. Jackson, you told us at sidebar the other day that you are withdrawing that motion, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right, so Mr. Clerk, that's motion 285, paper 285, withdrawn by counsel.
So after all that fighting, it's now over. This is something I'll be anxious to hear about at trial.
We are off and running for jury selection in what could be a lengthy process. For starters, you know, the judge was asking everyone in the gallery, these potential jurors, about 100 folks, whether or not they knew anything about the case, and almost every single person raised their number.
The first day of jury selection, almost 100 people were brought in and given questionnaires to fill out. The judge asked if any potential jurors had any kind of hardship that would prevent them from serving, like scheduled surgery or plane tickets. 46 people, almost half, raised their hands. Now remember, this trial may last 2 months, so jury duty in this case is not going to be easy. When asked if they had heard of the case, 69 people raised their hands, and 24 of them had already formed an opinion. Now, hearing about the case doesn't necessarily mean that a potential juror can't serve. As long as they can be fair and follow the law, they can still be chosen. This pattern repeated daily, but finally, after 5 days of questioning, 401 potential jurors, 19 were chosen. Two of those 19 were dismissed before swearing in the final 17. There will be 12 jurors and 4 alternates, and the jury is made up of 10 women and 7 men of various ages. Although the buffer zone is in effect, Karen Reed supporters still showed up daily, remaining 200 feet from the courthouse. They carried signs that said Free Karen Reed, Factually Innocent, and Truth and Justice for John. Supporters wore pink as a show of solidarity for the woman that they've spent 2 years supporting, and they cheered for her and her attorneys as they arrived and walked through the sea of pink toward the courthouse stairs. The families were seated, the jury sworn in, and 27 months to the day after Officer John O'Keefe tragically lost his life, the trial of his girlfriend and accused murderer finally began. First up are the opening statements, where the prosecutor and the defense attorney both have a chance to address the jury directly. The only time that they're able to do that is during opening statements and closing arguments. Other than that, the attorneys on either side have to relay all information by walking each witness through a line of questioning to elicit the information and evidence that they need the jury to know. That's why this is a big moment. Opening statements are incredibly important, possibly one of the most critical aspects of any trial. This is counsel's opportunity to present their case, outlining what they intend to show through the testimony and evidence, so that the jury is able to clearly understand the general story of what happened. That way, as each witness comes up, they have a point of reference so that they know how each person, or what they're presenting, fits into the theory that has been laid out for them by each side. First up is ADA Adam Lally. Lally begins by telling the jury that he wants to provide a roadmap to help navigate. I'm going to be honest. The roadmap that Lally provided was incredibly hard to follow, and I'm not the only one who thought so.
You never get a second chance to make a first impression. That is one reason why opening statements are so key to winning a trial.
Prosecution is coming out a little slow. You know, they're very stagnant with their presentation of the case, and I wonder if that's part of their strategy, but really only time will tell.
I know that the prosecution is putting on its case right now, but so far, I feel like I'm watching the defense put on its case. How can that be?
The state's open was lackluster. Too in the weeds, too many names the jury didn't need to know, and too hard to follow. Overall, very ineffective storytelling.
The jury is coming into this having just been sworn in and not knowing anything about this case or who all is involved. And unfortunately, the opening statements from the Commonwealth were way too hard to follow. Within the first 5 or 6 minutes, Lally has already listed 13 different names. And by the end, he listed 76. 76 people in a 38-minute opening. That's telling the jury a new name every 30 seconds for 38 minutes straight. I couldn't even follow when I listened, and I know most of the names because I've been researching this case for so long. Lally also seems to have a very monotone voice, so even in the moments where he's telling the jury that he's going to show them evidence to prove that Karen Reed should be found guilty of murder, his voice doesn't change, and he shows no passion or excitement, so any of the evidence that he brings up is basically overlooked because it's just lost in what feels like a monotone roll call. But some of what he said is really important for the jury to hear, so I want to go over it. Just maybe not with clips for this part. Officer John O'Keefe was only 46 years old when he passed. He grew up in Braintree, not far from Canton. John was named after his father, John O'Keefe Sr., who was there in the courtroom during these statements, right by John's mom. John O'Keefe was a proud member of the Boston Police Department, working as a patrolman, which can have some crazy hours, but that's okay since he wasn't married and he didn't have kids of his own yet, although he did get to be an uncle to his brother and his sister's kids. Tragically, in 2013, John's sister lost her battle with cancer. She and her husband had two young children at the time of her passing, a boy and a girl. And John, being the kind of man he was, made plans to step in and help out. He planned to move in with his brother-in-law so that he could help raise his niece and nephew. But before they could even finalize everything, John's brother-in-law passed away as well, only months after his wife. John stepped up and he became the kid's legal guardian, changing his whole life around so that he could take care of the children. The Boston Police Department were able to transfer him from patrolman to the sex crimes unit so that way he could have a more regular schedule with better hours. And John moved into the house in Canton with his niece and nephew. Now, this was a big transition, but Lally said that John had his friends, Jen McCabe and Carrie Roberts, there in Canton to help him as he navigated this new role as a parent. Time flies in the world of parenting. John assumed the role of guardian when his niece was about 6 and his nephew was only 3. So fast forward 8 years and his niece is getting an acceptance letter to a private high school that she had applied to. And even better, her best friend was accepted also. The girls were really excited and John is actually friends with the other girl's dad, Michael Camerano. So they came over to celebrate the acceptance letters together. John's nephew was sleeping over at a friend's house that night, and the girls are older. His niece is 14 by this time, so John and Michael decide to leave the girls to hang out at home, and they go and get out of the house for a bit. They head over to CF McCarthy's around 7:30, and Lally tells the jury that they're going to see videos and receipts and things like that to kind of track everything that was going on during that time. So the guys are out, they're having fun. They call another buddy and convince him to come down there, and there's also some other people in the bar that they knew and hung out with that night. The jury will also hear testimony from them. Sometime around 9, Karen Reed joins the party. Karen and John met in 2004 and briefly dated, but then lost touch. They reconnected through social media during the pandemic, so the last couple of years, she would stay at John's a few nights a week and help with the kids. Lally says that in the months leading to John's death, their relationship had gotten rocky, and he tells the jury that they'll see text messages and hear testimony from the kids and some other people who have witnessed some issues between them. One incident in particular that he brings up is a trip to Aruba for New Year's Eve the month before. John, Karen, and the kids were invited on a big group trip to Aruba organized by John's friend, Laura Sullivan. Laura's sister is there as well, and she actually runs into John in the lobby, giving him a hug. Karen's in the area when this happens, and she sees this interaction. Lally says that she starts screaming and cussing at this woman, who then starts screaming and cussing back. John and Karen go to the room, and Lally said that they engage in a screaming fight for 20 minutes in front of the kids. Lally said that there are texts in Karen's phone about this whole Aruba trip incident, and apparently she thought that she saw John making out with this woman, not just hugging her, so she thought that John was cheating. He told the jury that they will also see texts between Karen and Brian Higgins, who, of course, is friends with John and Karen, and he says that the texts are romantic in nature, and she references this Aruba incident there as well. Whatever issues they were having, they seemed to be in good spirits while they were out that night. So while this group is hanging out at C.F. McCarthy's, there's another group forming over at Waterfall Bar and Grill just a couple doors down. Jen McCabe, one of John's friends, and her sister Nicole Albert and their families. Lally gives all the specifics about who's who for every one of them and says that they will all testify. Now, I'll spare you on the who's who here since we've been through this extensively in previous episodes. Lally tells the jury that earlier that day, John had taken his nephew to the pizza place owned by Chris Albert, and they had briefly discussed plans for the evening about possibly going out. We have heard over and over that Julie texted John to come hang out, but Lally says that it was Chris who texted him and told him to come to Waterfall with the rest of the Alberts and McCabes and Brian Higgins. Lally tells the jury that they'll hear testimony from a number of people at C.F. McCarthy's and Waterfall that night, including one of the friends who left around the same time as John and Karen and said that she saw Karen approaching the driver's side of the SUV. He tells the jury about Julie Albert leaving with a headache and Chris Albert walking home. He says that Caitlin Albert and her boyfriend Tristan were at Waterfall earlier with the family for dinner, but at some point Tristan left. He tells them that Brian Albert and Brian Higgins had gone to a funeral for a fallen police officer in New York City, but they came home early to beat the weather, so they just decided to meet everyone at Waterfall. Shortly after midnight, it starts to snow, and some of the people at Waterfall go to 34 Fairview to keep the party going. The homeowner's son, Brian Albert Jr., has a birthday tomorrow, so he has some friends and family over, including Colin Albert. As the crew heads out to 34 Fairview, Jen McCabe and John O'Keefe share a couple of exchanges on the phone to figure out where he's going because he's never been there. Lally says that as the group from Waterfall is arriving at the house, Colin Albert is leaving with Jen's daughter, who is also his cousin, Allison McCabe. One of the guests in the house for Brian Jr.'s birthday called her brother, Ryan Nagel, to come pick her up. Ryan Nagel, his friend, and his girlfriend were turning left onto Fairview as Karen and John were coming from the opposite direction, about to turn right onto Fairview. Lally said that the truck that Nagel was in flashed the lights to signal for Karen to go ahead. Then they ended up at the same house, parked along the road facing the same direction, with Nagel parked behind Karen. Lally says that witnesses saw Karen stop the car and then pull up a little bit further and then pull up a little bit further until she's in front of the flagpole where John is found the next day. Lally also says that the witnesses in the truck will testify that they saw John in the car with Karen when they flashed the lights before they turned onto Fairview Road. And he said that they will say that nobody exited the SUV, there were no footprints, and no damage to the car when they left. He also said that everyone in the house will testify that John did not come in. Lally says that since they saw the car pull away, the Alberts and McCabes just kind of assumed that John and Karen left. Lally tells the jury that they'll hear testimony from John's niece that Karen woke up around 4:30 a.m., frantic, saying that John didn't come home, and that they'll also hear testimony from Jen McCabe that the niece called her and put Karen on the phone. He said that Karen said the last time that she saw John was at Waterfall, and Jen reminds her that she left Waterfall with John, and Jen says that she saw them parked outside of her house that night. Lally says that it will come out through the evidence that Karen was driving around that morning. Then she called Carrie Roberts and goes to Jen McCabe's, at which point she tells Jen that she cracked her taillight sometime prior to that. Now, Jen gets in the driver's seat because Karen is so hysterical, and they drive back to John's house. Lally said when they arrived, Karen showed Jen and Carrie that her taillight was cracked and missing some pieces. When they leave to go look for John, Lally said that Karen is insistent that they go to 34 Fairview. He tells the jury that Karen is in the back seat and is the only one who sees John. He said that Jen McCabe dials 911, and shortly after is when officers and responders arrive. He also says that dash cam will show the conditions outside, and that while they're waiting there, according to Lally, at 6:23 and 6:24, Karen tells Jen to search how long does someone have to be left in the cold to die from hypothermia. He tells the jury that there will be some dispute about the timing of the search, but he says that he has expert witnesses that will address it. Lally also says something here that isn't in the court documents that we haven't seen up to this point. He tells the jury that he has video footage at the temple that shows Karen driving away from Fairview that evening. Now, we've known about video at this temple from 12:17 a.m. when they were on the way to 34 Fairview after leaving Waterfall. And we know about footage here at 5:18 a.m. when Karen is driving to Jen McCabe's house. But having video from that night wasn't mentioned in the PCA or the statement of case. Lally also tells the jury that Karen drove around Canton for about half an hour. And he says that he anticipates the phone evidence showing that she drove toward Fairview Road before she went to meet Jen. Lally also tells the jury that they will hear about the injuries that John sustained. He says there's evidence that he had been out there for a long time and says that Karen said to a responder, quote, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him," end quote. He explains that John was taken to Good Samaritan Hospital and was pronounced dead at approximately 7:50 a.m. The jury hears about the statements that Karen made about harming herself, and he says that there will be testimony that Karen told responders that the last time she talked to John was when she was dropping him off, and they argued. He says dash cam at 8:22 a.m. shows Karen's cracked taillight, and that they will hear testimony from a state trooper that, based on data recovered from Karen's car, will opine that at 12:45 a.m., Karen was in front of Fairview Road, traveled more than 60 feet in reverse, going approximately 24.2 miles per hour. This is something we definitely want to pay attention to during trial. We've heard that there's a voicemail from Karen to John's phone at 12:41, where she leaves him a voicemail and you can hear her at home. It says that she's closing the door and you can hear her high heels on the garage floor. So one or the other will have to be proven wrong here. Lally also tells the jury about the CERT team search and what was recovered, and also that the taillight pieces were recovered during the second search, and then more searches later on as the snow melted. He says that the cocktail glass located on the bumper looks to be the same one that's in the video that John exited the waterfall with, and says he has injuries on his hand and arm where he was carrying the glass. He says there's an evaluator from the lab who will testify that she fit the broken pieces of taillight together, and he tells the jury they will hear testimony from a DNA analyst who will link John's DNA to the broken drinking glass and the taillight, and said that she will give an opinion that the hair that was found is consistent with a hair from John O'Keefe. Finally, Lally tells the jury that the medical examiner will explain to them the injuries that John sustained. It wasn't a clear or effective opening, and it was really hard to follow. Not only because of all of the names, but because he didn't go in a linear or chronological order. He bounces back and forth from one topic to the next and then back to the last topic. It took a really long time for me to even organize the transcript enough to be able to present it as clearly as I could. It's not a great start for the jury, but maybe the prosecution has enough evidence that they don't have to worry about something like that. Lally closed out his opening statements by saying this.
And I thank you very much for your attention today, and I thank you for the anticipation of your close attention as we go through all of the witnesses and all the evidence in this case. that second time that I do get to address you, what I'll be asking you to do, based on the evidence, and again, as the court has instructed you, you are the sole arbiters of the facts of this case. You are the ones who find what the facts, and I reiterate that, the facts, and what the evidence demonstrates in this case. And what I submit to you at that time, that second time, is that the only true and just verdict based on that is that the defendant, Karen Reed, is guilty of murder in the second degree, striking the victim, Mr. O'Keefe, with her car, knocking him back onto the ground, striking his head on the ground, causing the bleeding in his brain, swelling, and then leaving him there for several hours in a blizzard with temperatures in the teens, wind swirling around, snow piling up on his body until she comes with Mrs. McCabe and Mrs. Roberts just after 6 a.m. And that she is also guilty of vehicular manslaughter, operating under the influence of liquor, and that she is also guilty of leaving the scene after causing death. Thank you very much for your time.
The defense's opening was the total opposite of the Commonwealth's. It had everybody's attention, it was easy to follow, and it was explosive. Here's how defense attorney David Unetti started out.
Karen Reed was framed. Her car never struck John O'Keefe. She did not cause his death. And that means that somebody else did. You will learn that it was no accident that John O'Keefe was found dead on the front lawn of 34 Fairview Road in Canton on January 29th of 2022. You will learn that at that address lived a well-known and well-connected law enforcement family in Canton, the Alberts. Because the Alberts were involved, and because they had close connections to the investigators in this case, Karen Reed was framed for a murder she did not commit. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. As I previously told you, my name is David Unetti. I'm an attorney with an office in Boston. Together with attorneys Alan Jackson and Elizabeth Little, it is truly my privilege and my honor to represent Karen Reed during this trial.
That was an amazing opening. He came out powerful, he came out confident, and he clearly laid out exactly what he wants the jury to know, expect, and what to look for. After a long and monotone opening from the prosecution, David Unetti just woke this jury up. Imagine sitting through the first 38 minutes and thinking this is going to be your life for the next 7 weeks. And then bam, suddenly you're hanging on to every word. That is a skillful attorney. Unetti continues by telling the jury that right from the beginning, they're going to see a lot of problems in the Commonwealth's theory and evidence.
From a very early juncture in this case, you will question the Commonwealth's theory of the case. You will question the quality of the Commonwealth's evidence. You will question the veracity of the Commonwealth's witnesses. And you will question their shoddy, biased investigation, a faulty investigation that led to Karen Reed sitting here today. You will learn, in short, that the police did no real investigation of this case, and you will question why. You'll question why the investigators had such tunnel vision. You'll question why they focused solely on Karen Reed, someone with no ties to the Canton Police Department, as opposed to the well-known and well-connected Albert family of Canton, family that was never treated as suspects by the investigators in this case. Boston police officer John O'Keefe was found mortally injured on Brian Albert's front lawn. His body was in full view and almost right below Brian Albert's bedroom window on his front lawn. He was found wearing only one sneaker. You'll learn that Brian Albert was a Boston police officer as well, and that he was a trained first responder. Brian Albert was notified that another police officer was injured and unresponsive on his front lawn, and Brian Albert did nothing. His sister-in-law, Jennifer McCabe, and other civilians were on his property that morning after John O'Keefe's body was found. Police, EMTs, firefighters, police cruisers, and an ambulance fire truck, lights flashing. And first responder Brian Albert never came out of his house.
There are a lot of names in this case, and it can get very overwhelming. So rather than going down the list and clouding the jury's understanding with more names than they're going to be able to remember at once anyway, Unetti is doing a great job here of focusing on this being a family. The Albert family. The Albert family. A conspiracy or a cover-up that involves a ton of people is not going to be believable by most jurors. But Unetti's making sure that the jury understands this is not a frame job by a bunch of random people. This is a family that's protecting their own, according to their theory. Now Unetti's going to start expanding on who's in charge of this investigation that he says has so many problems, and their connections to the family. And this gets a little wild, y'all.
Equally important to you will be the fact that the lead homicide investigators never went inside the Albert home that. You'll learn that Brian Albert's brother, Kevin Albert, is a Canton police officer. It was obvious very early on that the Canton police should not be investigating the death of a man found on the property of the brother of a Canton police officer. So it was decided just about from the start that the Massachusetts State Police should take complete control of this investigation because the Canton police were conflicted out. Now, that sounded good at the time, but you'll learn that two major problems arose. First, despite the fact that they obviously had a conflict of interest, the evidence will show that the Canton police still had their hands in this investigation. You will find it astounding. But Canton police officer Kevin Albert, the reason for the conflict of interest in the first place, was continually updated about the status of this investigation while it was going on. Second, and equally troubling, is that the lead state police detective who was assigned to this case was a man named Michael Proctor. Michael Proctor, you will learn, is one of the many people in Canton with deep ties to the Albert family. Michael Proctor's own mother refers to the Alberts as the Proctor's second family. His own sister's wedding, Michael Proctor was in the wedding party with Colin Albert. And he sat at the head table of that wedding with members of the Albert family. That's the man who was chosen to lead the investigation into the suspicious death on the property of Brian Albert. That's the man who gave updates to Canton police officer Kevin Albert while the state police were supposed to be investigating what had occurred at his brother Brian Albert's house. You'll learn that right from the jump, Michael Proctor predetermined the outcome of this case. Never stepped foot inside the Albert home on January 29th, 2022. Never checked out whether there were any signs of struggle inside that home. He never called for crime scene technicians and other specialists to look for blood or other trace evidence within the home. He never asked Brian Albert for permission to go in the home and take a look around. Michael Proctor never applied for a search warrant to go in that home. Instead, he focused immediately and exclusively on Karen Reed, the outsider.
Unetti points out that Karen doesn't have those deep ties to the Alberts that everyone else does, and he calls her a convenient outsider. He has now told the jury that Karen is innocent, that someone else is responsible, and he's pointed out conflicts with the lead investigator. It's nothing new to see a defense attorney accuse investigators of tunnel vision or bad policing. It's actually one of the most common defenses there is. But what happens next is anything but common.
So how did Michael Proctor feel about her? How did he treat somebody he was investigating at a point in time when he should have been keeping an open mind and focusing on obtaining all possible evidence so that he didn't miss anything? Well, you will learn that on the very day that John O'Keefe was found dead on Brian Albert's lawn, Michael Proctor was texting with his high school buddies about this supposedly secret investigation. using his personal cell phone. He was revealing information about this investigation to his friends, assuming that nobody would ever find out what he was doing or what he was saying. And he was revealing his true thoughts about Karen Reed to his friends. Not what he put in his sanitized police reports. His true feelings. To his friends, whom he trusted, and in text messages that he never thought would come into the hands of the defense in this case. Lead investigator Trooper Michael Proctor, right from the start, called Karen Reed names you would reserve only for your worst enemies. He told his friends that he hoped that she would kill herself. He told his friends that he had seized her cell phone. And you will learn that he knew he shouldn't have been accessing any content on her cell phone because he knew there would likely be attorney-client communications on between Karen and me at that time. He knew that he was supposed to wait for a search warrant or other permission from a judge in order to go through that phone. But you'll learn that he went through the phone anyway, without permission. And you'll know that he did because he told his high school buddies that he was searching her phone for nude photos of Karen Reed. And he was disappointed he hadn't found any yet. That is the professional and unbiased investigator who was chosen to lead the investigation into the death of John O'Keefe. You will learn that one of Michael Proctor's high school friends commented to him that with a dead body on the front lawn, the homeowner in this case is surely going to catch a lot of grief. And you know what Michael Proctor's response to that was? One word. Nope. And he explained why. Michael Proctor assured his buddies that the homeowner would not catch a lot of grief because, quote, the homeowner's a Boston cop too, end quote. That one sentence, ladies and gentlemen, Mike, in Michael Proctor's own words, will explain a lot to you about how this investigation was conducted.
This is huge. This is game-changing, really. Let's break this down. Imagine being on a jury and you know nothing about the case. The first thing you hear in openings from the defense is that the lead investigator has deep-rooted family ties to the Albert family, went through a phone without a warrant, looked for nude photos of the defendant and then laughed about it to his friends, and wished her dead. If a man can wish you dead, could he not also wish you locked up for life? We'll be right back. I don't see how this couldn't have an impact on the level of trust that the jury will have for Proctor now. 10 of the seated jurors are women who just listened to this attorney tell them that the lead investigator on this case was looking for nude photos in Karen's phone. You can't unring that bell. Yannetti also tells the jury that based on this, they're going to have to decide how much weight they put on anything that comes from Proctor. Yannetti goes on to give some examples of things that he wants the jury to know about when it comes to the lead investigator.
You will learn that Michael Proctor showed up at Karen Reed's parents' house in Dighton to interview her during the afternoon of January 29, only hours after John O'Keefe's body was found dead on Brian Albert's front lawn. You'll learn that Michael Proctor had her Lexus SUV towed from her parents' home. But you'll also learn that he wrote a search warrant in which he falsified the time that he took that SUV. He swore under oath that the vehicle wasn't towed until 5:30 p.m. But you'll learn that we obtained surveillance footage that he didn't know we would get. And that surveillance footage exposed that Michael Proctor's words in that sworn affidavit were a lie. Michael Proctor had that vehicle for about 90 minutes before he claimed to have taken. And folks, you will learn that the timing is important, very important. Because when John O'Keefe was first found on Brian Albert's front lawn, The police thoroughly searched that yard for potential evidence. And it wasn't just one officer, or two, or three. There were at least four officers that searched that front lawn. And that morning was the beginning of a snowstorm, but there wasn't yet much snow on the ground when they were searching that lawn. It was light out by the time they did the search, and it was getting lighter. And during that thorough search of Brian Albert's front lawn, the number of pieces of tail light that were found by a minimum of four officers looking for evidence was zero. It was only later in the day, when the snow was really starting to accumulate, that the police miraculously started to find pieces of tail light on the property. The police only started to find pieces of tail light after Michael Proctor had seized Cameron Reed's car. They only started to find pieces of tail light after Michael Proctor had possession of her tail light. You'll learn that Trooper Michael Proctor then kept going back to the Albert residence after that day, and he claims to have kept finding pieces of taillight on multiple occasions on multiple different days. And in addition, a good week after John O'Keefe's death, Canton Police Chief Kenneth Berkowitz, an older officer on the brink of retirement with probably not the best eyesight, he supposedly was driving, happened to be driving past Brian Albert's house. And by the way, Brian Albert is someone with whom Chief Berkowitz is also good friends. And this older man allegedly spotted yet another piece of taillight from his moving vehicle. This was yet another piece of taillight that was somehow missed by the trained specialists who had previously and thoroughly searched the property. Another piece of taillight that Proctor supposedly missed in the many times he went back to the property. Michael Proctor claims that he kept finding pieces of taillight right up until February 18th of 2022, which was nearly 3 weeks after John O'Keefe was found dead on Brian Albert's. You will learn that there is no competent evidence that Karen Reed's taillight shattered at Brian Albert's property in the early morning hours of January 29th of 2022. To the contrary, you'll learn that when Karen left John at Brian Albert's house, she drove back to John's house on Meadows Ave across town in Canton. At John's home, where he lived with his two adopted children, Karen was drifting in and out of sleep, but she woke up for good in a panic sometime around 4 a.m. because John hadn't come home. And that was not like him at all. He had never done that before. Karen had a sinking feeling that something was wrong. So she got back into her Lexus. She backed up out of the garage to leave the driveway. And when she did, the right rear taillight of her Lexus struck John's parked vehicle in the driveway, and her taillight cracked.
David Unetti is laying out a full and comprehensive story for the jury, and he's taking each piece of evidence that will be brought up and effectively poking holes in it before they have a chance to let it sway them, leading them directly to any and all reasonable doubt. He goes on to mention Ryan Nagel, the witness who was parked behind Karen in front of 34 Fairview, and says he saw no taillight damage to her car. He tells the jury, don't be fooled by this shady taillight business. You'll see a video where she hits John's car when she's backing out of the garage. He brings up Karen in a panicked state, racking her brain when John wasn't home, trying to figure out what was happening and make sense of it all. In her hysterics, questioning if the worst could have happened, if she could have hit him, did she hit him? Saying it to herself and to other people, unable to think of anything else that could make sense. He tells the jury, that was 2 years ago. That was before she knew anything or could have thought anything else.
She certainly didn't consider in a million years that someone from within the Albert home could have beaten up John and left him to die on the front lawn. Now, that was over 2 years ago. Karen didn't know then what you will learn during this trial. Karen didn't know that Brian Albert's sister-in-law, Jennifer McCabe, left the after-hours party at Brian Albert's house sometime after Karen pulled away. She didn't know that after Jennifer McCabe dropped off some people elsewhere, she returned to her own home. Karen didn't know that Jennifer McClicade climbed some stairs in her home and eventually made it into her bedroom with her cell phone. Karen didn't know that Jennifer McCabe settled in at 2:27 in the morning on January 29, 2022, and typed a Google search that she would later delete. 2:27 in the morning was over 3 hours before John O'Keefe's body was found on Brian Albert's lawn. 2:27 was over 3 hours before anyone knew or suspected that John O'Keefe was missing or hurt or in trouble. And at 2:27 in the morning, you will learn that with no one watching her, thinking she was alone with her thoughts, and not worrying that anyone would know what she was doing, Jennifer McCabe typed in the following Google search: how long to die in the cold?
Yannetti tells the jury that there will be a dispute over the time search. That's going to turn into a battle of the experts, just like the medical examiners will. Yannetti also brings up Lucky, the snowplow driver.
And you know who else saw no one laying outside in the early morning hours of January 29th? The snowplow driver in charge of plowing the street for the city of Kent. And this is another big problem for the Commonwealth. You will learn that Michael Proctor, here's that name again, wrote a report where he claimed that the DPW supervisor had told him that Fairview Road had not been plowed that night. Proctor's total investigation on this issue consisted of one phone call and no follow-up. He just submitted his report that simply said the road hadn't been plowed that night, and perhaps thinking that no one else would follow up either. But you'll learn that when it came to finding out the truth, it's not that Proctor couldn't find the truth, it's that he wouldn't. But fortunately, you'll learn that we would, and we did. You'll learn that within weeks after January 29th, we sent our investigator, a former Medford police officer named Paul Makowski, to the Canton DPW to try to get to the bottom of this. Paul Makowski talked to the same supervisor at the DPW, a man named Michael Trotta, whom Proctor claimed had told him that the street hadn't been plowed that night. You'll learn that Paul Makowski found out that Michael Proctor was not telling the truth. You'll learn that Michael Trotta from the DPW told Paul Makowski, our investigator, that the street was indeed plowed that night, and that the name of the plow driver was Brian Loughran. So Paul Makowski tracked down Brian Loughran. He asked Mr. Loughran if the state police or any investigators had ever spoken to him. And the answer came back, no. You will then learn what Brian Loughran had to say about what he saw and didn't see that night, and you will be shocked. Brian Loughran told Paul Makowski that he was driving a big snowplow in Canton that night. You'll learn that the nickname for it at the DPW was Frankenstein, because it had a lot of spare parts and it had been around forever. Brian Loughran told Paul Makowski that when he plows the streets of Canton in Frankenstein, he's very careful. He makes sure to check not only the roads in front of him, but also the yards to the side of his plow. He makes sure not to hit a fire hydrant or a tree or an animal, or heaven forbid, a person lying in the snow. He's always on the lookout. You'll learn that Brian Loughran passed by 34 Fairview in his plow, traveling right by Brian Albert's front lawn at 2:30 in the morning. You'll learn that Brian Loughran confirms that at about 2:30, when he went by that house, John O'Keefe was not on that front lawn. So you'll learn that about 2 hours after the Commonwealth claims that Karen Reed somehow incapacitated John O'Keefe, an eyewitness confirms that not only could it not have happened, but it didn't happen. But you'll learn that Brian Loughran also provides some other troubling testimony for the Commonwealth. You'll learn that after making that pass at 2:30 in the morning and seeing no body, he showed up again at the entrance to Fairview Road, intending to make another pass down it with his plow. This time, however, at about 3:30 in the morning, he looked down the street and he saw that parked right next to Brian Albert's front lawn, right in the very area where John O'Keefe's body was later found at 6 a.m., Brian Laughlin saw a Ford Edge parked on the side of the road. You will learn that the police have done zero investigation to discover whose Ford Edge that was. You'll learn that members of the Albert family drove Ford Edges. You'll learn that the police to this day claim not to know who was parked right next to the area where John O'Keefe's body was later found. You will learn that while investigators on this case, including Michael Frock, completely ignored the snowplow driver who went right by the Albert residence, the defense not only tracked him down and interviewed him, but the plow driver actually took our investigator on a ride back past the residence to explain the precise route that he had taken on January 29th.
Yannetti continues on, telling the jury about conversations between Brian Albert and Brian Higgins at 2:22 a.m. And he tells the jury that they had denied talking to anyone before being confronted with phone records. He then breaks down a chronological time frame that he tells the jury is suspicious.
You will learn about the following in chronological order. 2:12 a.m., Jennifer McCabe arrives at her home. 2:22 a.m., Brian Albert calls Brian Higgins. 2:22 a.m., 17 seconds later, Higgins calls him back. And Brian Albert and Brian Higgins are on the phone together for 22 seconds. 2:23 a.m., Jennifer McCabe climbs the stairs to her bedroom. 2:27 a.m., Jennifer McCabe searches on Google, how long to die in the cold. 2:30 a.m., plow driver Brian Laughlin confirms there was no body on Brian Albert's front lawn. 3:30 a.m., Brian Laughlin confirms that a Ford Edge was parked right where John O'Keefe's body was later found. The Commonwealth will not be able to successfully dispute any of those facts, yet I expect that they will persist in asking you to convict Karen Reed anyway. You will learn that there are other major problems with the Commonwealth's theory. You'll learn that when John O'Keefe was found, he did not look like he had been hit by a car. You'll learn that he looked to have been attacked and beaten up. You'll learn that John O'Keefe was a large 6'2" man who, if positioned behind a Lexus SUV, would have had his torso completely exposed to the rear of that vehicle, including to the taillight. You'll learn that no part of his torso was injured. There was no bruising, no redness, no scratches, no punctures. You'll learn that his chest and hips and legs were pristine, despite the Commonwealth's contention that he was hit by a 6,000-pound vehicle. The evidence will show that what was not pristine was his right arm. You will take one look at that arm, and you will conclude that a car did not cause those injuries.
This has been one of the theories that the defense has had that they are pursuing in trial. Chloe, the German Shepherd, who was rehomed around the time the grand jury testimony was happening. Yannetti addresses the Aruba trip as well and says, yeah, there were issues that stemmed from that. And that caused Karen to consider other options, like Brian Higgins. But he says that never went anywhere. And in fact, John and Karen had been planning a trip together with another couple months into the future. He tells the jury that while there has been arguing in their history, that's typical of all couples, and there was never any type of violence. He asked the jury to remember the things that Trooper Proctor was doing and saying from the very first day of this investigation. And then he has one more plea for them.
So folks, the trial is now about to start, and the witnesses are about to start testifying. On behalf of Karen Reed, I ask that you do two things during this trial. First, I ask that you pay attention to all of the evidence. The way trials work, the prosecution gets to present its case first. They conduct their direct examinations first. So we respectfully ask that you wait for us. We will get to cross-examine their witnesses, and you will find that cross-examination is the key that unlocks the truth. Wait for us. We'll be glad that you did. Second, I ask that you keep your eye on the ball. You have one job and one job only to do during this trial, and that job, quite frankly, is not to solve this case. Your only job during this trial is to determine whether the Commonwealth, the prosecution, has proven to you each and every element of the crimes they have charged, beyond a reasonable doubt, to a moral certainty. The prosecution will fail to prove this case to a moral certainty. They will fail to prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt. You will reasonably doubt their case because their theory of the case does not make sense. You will reasonably doubt their case because Karen Reed was framed, and the evidence shows that, despite the fact that the police never ever investigated that angle of this case at all. Because the prosecution will not prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt to a moral certainty, we will stand before you again at the end of this trial and ask that you find Karen Reed not guilty.
If the openings are any indication of how the next 7 weeks are going to go, this is going to be an intense couple of months. It's heartbreaking to see John O'Keefe Sr. and Peggy O'Keefe get emotional during testimony. As much as we want to fight for answers and truth and justice, at the center of all of this are grieving parents who have a tough road ahead. We have a long way to go and a lot in store over the next couple months. In the next episode, we will go over the testimony from John's brother, Paul, and his wife, Erin, and we'll talk about what they had to say about Karen Reed. We'll also hear from some of the first responders and a masterful cross-examination by attorney Alan Jackson. We have a lot to go over, so I'll see y'all soon. My name is Brandy Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.